coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
There I am. Sorry about that. Mute buttons and all. They glow red when you don't touch them. Good evening, everybody. Happy Tuesday night. Hope everybody's doing well. Hope everybody had a great St. Patrick's Day. Our astronauts are home. Big applause for them. Fantastic. Great to see the rescue mission go so well. We will be talking in the second part tonight after our commercial break with our good friend Mike Turber about the Boeing Starliner, what the failures were, how that came to begin with, how this literal Gilligan's Island story of an 8-day, 9-day space mission turning into 9 months came to be, and the literal issues going on with the compatibility between programs. It's just, it's mind-numbing to me that that none of these companies use the same umbilical cord for their life supports. None of them use the same spacesuits, anything like that. So even the fact that these astronauts returning home had to learn the emergency procedures and how to help land the craft and what their basic job is on a normal space mission, they had to learn that in a craft that they'd never stepped foot in while spinning around the Earth in orbit. So massive things had to be pushed to get these guys home. It's pretty amazing. So welcome back to them. In our first part, we will be joined by our good friend, Craig Woolheater. He is the founder of Cryptomundo, as well as Texas Bigfoot Conference, Texas UFO Con, and also the Phelps Monster Festival is going on this year. So we're having him on to talk about that, his involvement with the Phelps Monster Festival, and how that festival came to be, what it's all about, things like that. So welcome back to the show, Craig. How are you doing tonight?
Hey, Chris. Nice to see you.
Hey, you too, bud. I'm glad to see that you are well. You had a bit of an issue a few months ago, and glad to see that you are healed up and doing better.
Well, I appreciate that for sure. I do have a nice Frankenstein-style forehead scar, but other than that, I'm doing okay.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. Now, before we get into the Phelps Monster Festival and the official event, everything else, how did you first come into the world of cryptozoology? Because, of course, as I mentioned in the intro, you were one of the founders of Cryptomundo, literally the oldest website on the internet having to do with cryptozoology, cryptid sightings. How did you come into that world to begin with, Craig?
Well, as I was growing up as a young curious lad, I was interested in the strange and unusual as a child, and there was a strange and unusual series of events in 1969, in the summer of 1969, a creature that was seen by many people not that far from downtown Fort Worth, Texas, the Lake Worth Monster, it was dubbed, also the Goat Man of Greer Island. And it's weird that you even bring that up, because it has a tie-in with space exploration. The fact that it was on the front page of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram on July 10th and July 11th, seen by people out there. Actually, the first night, it was terrorized a couple in a car that were out there. And, you know, this is only 10 days before man first landed on the moon. Yep. So there is a tie in there with, you know, man's foray into space. But my grandparents lived there in Fort Worth. I lived in the Dallas area, and they saved the newspapers for me, the front page of the newspapers with these stories about this creature that was seen out there. And because I had a scrapbook with, you know, like I said, the strange and unusual stories in there. So they saved that for me for my scrapbook. And it was, kind of a local tie-in, bless you there, with the fact that my grandparents also had a cabin cruiser boat out at the marina on the upstream lake from Lake Worth at Eagle Mountain Lake. So basically that lake was separated by a dam from Lake Worth where this creature was roaming. My young impressionable brain was, thinking about running into the Lake Worth monster when we were out at the lake, because we would spend a lot of time out there in the summers out on the boat, anchored out in the lake, and just spend the weekend out on the boat in the lake there, jump off, go swimming, go fishing, whatever. So that was something that, like I said, was something that was very impressionable on me as a youth. Then about a year later, I got a book by an author who, come to find out, I share a birthday, at least the date, not the year, with John Keel.
Oh, wow.
Who wrote The Mothman Prophecies. He also wrote a book that came out in 1970 called Strange Creatures from Time and Space. It was just filled with, every chapter was about different creatures from around the world. There was a chapter on the Mothman in there, although his book, The Mothman Prophecies, didn't come out until 1975. But he and I were both born on March 25th. He in 1930 wow. and myself in 1960. So kind of a tie in there. But, the really thing that really solidified me deals with the Foul Monster, but that in 1973, after it went into nationwide release, I saw The Legend of Boggy Creek in a theater as a youth. And that movie was very impressionable. It made a great impression on me, and it was something that put the fear of Falk in me, I guess you could say, even. as I got into organized Bigfoot research, based in the Dallas area, we made forays out to Falk, Arkansas. Became close friends with Smokey Crabtree, who was the location scout for that movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek. Okay. And spent time with him and started networking with other Bigfoot people, co-founded the Texas Bigfoot Research Center and started doing Bigfoot research and collecting reports, investigating reports, talking to people who reported sightings and such. So, in the late 90s, I really got involved with that. And like I said, one of the first people that I became good friends with that was Smokey Crabtree. And so I spent a lot of time out there in Falk. We would celebrate his birthday several years, April 22nd. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2016. Yep. His last public appearance was at the final under these organizers, Boggy Creek Festival, was in 2015, and he made a brief appearance there. And then that organization that put that event together kind of fell apart. They were wanting to move it to Texarkana. They had talks to move it to Texarkana. As a matter of fact, a little funny story is the mayor of Texarkana. Of course, I don't know if it was the mayor of Texarkana or the mayor of Arkansas, because that city is split right down the middle.
Yeah.
But called my good friend, Mayor Terry Purvis, the mayor of Falk. And basically, I guess, kind of asked him what his thoughts were on moving the Boggy Creek Festival to Texarkana as opposed to Falk. And Mayor Terry quipped rather quickly that, you know, he didn't mind at all as long as the Texarkana Art Festival was going to be moving to Falk. And negotiations kind of fell apart there. Anyway, after the 2018 Texas Bigfoot Conference in Jefferson, which I've been organizing and hosting since 2001, the very first one, 4 days after 9/11.
Yeah.
But we usually would, the Sunday after the event in Jefferson, would take a trek up to Falk, which is only an hour away. And we showed up with a group of people. You know, Falk is population a little over 800. And really, other than the Monster Mart there, there's not really a whole lot to see in Falk.
Not really.
So anyway, we brought a group of, I don't know, 30 or 40 people out there that piled into the Monster Mart at the same time. And Mayor Terry Purvis just happened to be there talking to Denny, the owner of the Monster Mart, and asked, you know, Mayor Terry asked, well, you know, what are all these people from? Where'd y'all come from? And I told him that, you know, we just ended up the Texas Bigfoot Conference in Jefferson. So we brought a crew of people up to Falk to come check out the Monster Mart in Falk. You know, a lot of people had not been there, but, you know, they all knew about the legend of Boggy Creek. So we just had a caravan of people that went up there, and he lamented the fact that, you know, he wished that they still had some kind of event there in Falk, you know, celebrating the history of the Falk Monster there, or you know, if you want to call it the Boggy Creek Monster, and the film The Legend of Boggy Creek. And as someone who I guess I could say professionally organizes these types of events. I told him that, you know, I'd be honored to put together a conference, an event, you know, celebrating those things there in Falk to bring people to town to, you know, check out the surroundings there in Falk, the environment, check out things and to bring, you know, there's not any experts in the Bigfoot field. There's experts in knowledge about things of that such. So, you know, I started up the event and hosted it in 2019 for the first time. And we brought in, we had to turn people away at the door.
Yeah.
At the Falk Community Center. It sold out, and I presented one of those huge, giant joke checks made out to the Falk Independent School District for $3,000 that was a donation from the proceeds of the event to the school district. Since then, I've started up, just like I have in Jefferson, the Texas Bigfoot Scholarship Fund. I have in Falk the Falk Monster Scholarship Fund.
Fantastic.
Where we, you know, we give away a donation to graduating senior students there in Falk and in Jefferson. So we do give, you know, give back to the community. Yep. The community has, you know, supported these events. And so we appreciate the fact that they open, you know, welcome us with open arms, and they appreciate the fact that we bring people to town, tourists to town to come spend money, you know, in their local establishments, buy gas at the gas station, you know, go to the Monster Mart and buy them a soda or a slice of pizza or whatever. But, you know, buy certainly at the Monster Mart, you know, load up on your Falk Monster souvenirs, because let me tell you, I was just there. What day did I go? I think I went, I think it was last Friday. And let me tell you, they have loaded up on even more stuff than I've ever seen. Wow. Bigfoot and Falcon Monster souvenirs. They've got a fresh load of everything there.
Yeah.
And I took some literature up there, some postcards to promote the event. Got to actually meet the guy that did the whatever you want to call it, the embellishments to the Monster Mart when it got updated with the Bigfoot and Falcon Monster exterior details, as well as the statues and stuff that he builds inside. But he was out there outside rigging up. He had just rigged up where the gas pumps used to be, a hammock there, and has a stuffed Bigfoot out there laying in the hammock, swaying in the breeze out there. And he was out there doing that. And it was rather windy, so he was having a little bit of a struggle with that. But I got to meet him. His name is Leroy Simmons. I had never met him to talk to him, but he was a rather interesting fellow. And I told him he needed to come down to Jefferson and work some of his magic down here for the Bigfoot capital of Texas, as he has there in Falk, the right. Bigfoot capital of Arkansas. So that's how I got interested and what I've been up to regarding the event in the recent past.
Well, and you really do put on some amazing community events. Like you said earlier, Texas Bigfoot Conference is literally, but I would venture to say, probably the oldest continuing Bigfoot conference in the country right now. There, at least in the running for it.
The Ohio one has been going continuously since 1989.
Okay. So
they've got me beat by about 12 years.
Close to it.
But so many people come in, you know, now you can't even swing a cat by the tail and not hit a Bigfoot conference or festival or something here in town. But when I got started, there was only about, as far as an annual event, there was Ohio, and there was Willow Creek, California, there was like more of a parade and celebration Bigfoot there in town. But up in British Columbia, there was a more of a scientific conference that was held off and on over the years, every couple of years. But you know, I attended the Ohio Bigfoot Conference in 2000, and shortly after forming the Texas Bigfoot Research Center, and was welcomed with open arms and, you know, great networking and meeting people in person as opposed to just on the internet. And I thought to myself, you know what? There's nothing like this in Texas. I bet that I could pull something like this off. Well, and so and that's how it all got started.
To amazing accolade you have, Craig. I've sponsored the show easily the last 5 years almost. It's fantastic. It's a great event. All of your events are awesome. And quite honestly, a minute ago, you mentioned, you know, like there are no Bigfoot experts. That is something that we definitely say on the show. What you have is people who are experts in certain fields of science, people who are experts in certain fields of wildlife research, people like Chester Moore, people who, like you've had Shelley Cummington Montana out, talking about tracking and gathering evidence, people like that who are experts in specific fields, who come and speak and talk. And, now granted though, you yourself, though you are not an expert, once again, have years of actual field research under your belt, especially with, once again, helping to found the Texas Bigfoot Research Organization. How long were you involved with them, doing field research, and what kind of things did you find? Because not a lot of people realize that there is a great amount of Bigfoot sightings here in the Lone Star State, so much that, like you said, you actually petitioned Jefferson to be Bigfoot capital of Texas and for the area to be protected domain for the species.
Correct. Marion County, which Jefferson is the county seat, in 2 years ago, 2 years ago now, signed a county resolution that Marion County was a safe haven for Bigfoot, and that for people not to harm, kill, pester, harass Bigfoot. You know, that was a county resolution that was passed 2 years ago. In 2017, I authored the town proclamation, and in 2018, February 12th, I believe, was signed by the mayor at that time, making Texas the official Bigfoot capital of Texas. Myself, I was involved in field research in the very beginning of the organization, when it was just myself and Luke Gross, who we co-founded it together. Back then, in the early days, you know, it was us. You know, we started picking up steam, and on the website, people wanting to get involved, and people submitting reports. And, you know, I've talked to hundreds of people over the years that that claim an encounter, a sighting, or found tracks. But I assembled a team of people that had the skills and the strengths and the knowledge, as you so succinctly mentioned earlier, that I did not have. My skills were in organizing and putting this together and doing promotion and public events, and assembled a team of wildlife biologists and scientists and law enforcement and, you know, ex-military that had these skills that I did not have, to be able to do field research and projects. I mean, we worked with governmental agencies, even, you know, we had a long-term camera project in the Big Thicket area of Texas, Southeast Texas, very swampy, very wooded, very desolate area, that we actually had a permit from the National Park Service, who governs the Big Thicket, to perform a camera study.
Exactly.
A long-term camera study for Bigfoot. We were an approved scientific research organization. We were issued a permit for this long-term camera study. They didn't laugh at us. They didn't scoff at us.
Why would
we
they?
We had to you know, file an annual report and submit copies of all the photographs that our remote cameras took, but we never, you know, got anything certainly that was conclusively a Bigfoot. There were some pictures that were inconclusive, that, you know, something in front of the camera moved in front of the camera that was hair covered that, you know, you couldn't make out. But we had cameras down in this, and for a period of time in the Sam Houston National Forest, that the U.S. Forest Service gave us permission to do this. We had cameras up in Southeast Oklahoma that the Nature Conservancy gave us permission to put these out. We were working with Texas Parks and Wildlife and submitting a DNA evidence that we collected, mostly in the form of bear hairs that were snared, and we put hair snares out to where we had cameras to try and see if we could collect, you know, hair sample from, you know, an upright bipedal hominid.
Yeah.
And we got a lot of bear hairs, and Texas Parks and Wildlife, who, you know, we had a relationship with Dwayne Schlitter, who was in charge of rare and endangered wildlife, knew who we were, knew what we were doing, and we submitted these bear hairs for them to compare to other bear hairs they were collecting in Texas, to try and determine where the bears were coming from,
that were coming into
Texas. And we submitted hairs that we were collecting in Southeast Oklahoma. So, I mean, you know, we weren't ridiculed or anything like that. And, you know,
That brings up two very important things that we speak about regularly on this show, Craig, which is number one, your chance specifically in the world of Bigfoot and cryptozoological research, your chance to actively shake hands with science and be seen as a citizen scientist, and the importance of protecting these areas. You know, like if you want to protect Bigfoot, you need to protect its habitat, which means you need to protect the animals in the habitat. So if you've got black bears roaming around, brown bears, you know, grizzlies, whatever, any kind of, no grizzlies here in Texas, but, you know, anything like that going on, the way you protect that habitat is to protect the animal. So the fact that you guys, because what they don't have money for, they may be able to fund you with a little bit of money for cameras. They may even provide you with a couple cameras. However, what they don't have money for is to loose five people into the middle of the big thicket five times a month to go out and get this stuff. So if you can shake hands with a local university that's doing bird counts, rare species counts, whatever, you now have an amazing opportunity to help them while they help you.
You know, I won't name the department or anything, but Baylor University, a department in Baylor University donated trail cameras to us in the past to again, to try and document this. So we had a, you know, we put on in 2006, we actually co-curated a museum exhibit titled Bigfoot in Texas ? With a campus of University of Texas in San Antonio.
Yep.
The Institute of Texan Cultures, which I understand that building is being demolished and
sadly,
the museum is being moved. It was built for the 1968 World's Fair. And it's actually I don't know the status of it right now, but it was a campus of University of Texas, San Antonio. And it is a museum called the Institute of Texan Cultures. Just recently been made aware that they were relocating the museum, but starting in the first part of 2005, because it took that long to put together a 2,000 square foot museum exhibit.
Yeah.
But it premiered in April of 2006 and ran through August of 2006. We put on four half-day mini conferences. We actually brought in the first one we did, we brought in Peter Byrne, who was actually, you know, put in charge by, what's his name? I can't think of his name. Tom of San Antonio, the Southwest Research Institute.
Mm.
Tom Slick.
Okay.
Not Tom Slick, the cartoon, the race car driver, but Tom Slick, the Texas oil man who mysteriously died in a plane crash, I believe, in 1962. Anyway, he funded the expeditions to the Himalayas for the Abominable Snowman, and also they're in Northern California. His institution is still there in San Antonio, Southwest Research Institute. And you know, they, you know, research with primates as well. And his niece, I can't remember her name, Catherine Cook, I believe it is, actually wrote an a biography about Tom Slick. And so she was there at the museum when Peter Byrne was there, because, like I said, Peter Byrne and Tom Slick were really good friends and colleagues. So we had her doing a book signing there at the museum at that time as well. But we brought in other, you know, big names had four weekend presentations. And it was their most attended special exhibit at that time.
I'll bet.
And it was a cool event. And again, this is with, a major state university.
Yep.
That wasn't ridiculed. We had at the very end, it had a very large Bigfoot that was holding two pails, buckets, and one had a sticker that said yes and one that said no. And the question was, what is your belief in Bigfoot? And so they gave washers out and to put the washers out and to see which bucket was heavier at the end of the day. So it was a really cool event. And so that's, some of the cool things that have been involved that I've been involved with in my now over 25 years of organized Bigfoot research, investigation, events and such. But the Falk Monster Festival Conference there is coming up April 25th and 26th.
Yep.
Just a little over a month away. We have a good lineup of speakers from Mitchell Whittington here in Jefferson, but he grew up in the Texarkana area and was very, very, very also influenced by the Falk Monster and the Legend of Boggy Creek. Daniel Allen Jones will be there as well as a speaker. We have Jeff Stewart. We have Chester Moore, the outdoorsman that you just spoke about. He's going to be giving a very cool presentation Friday night. We're having a catered barbecue dinner there in Falk, and he's going to be giving a presentation along, his dark outdoors presentation, but about the Phantom Killer of Texarkana.
Yeah.
That was made into a movie, The Town That Dreaded Sundown. So he's going to be giving a dark outdoors presentation there about that, as well as a Falk Monster presentation. Of course, Chester, he kind of jumps around, with wildlife and, he may be talking about Black Panthers, mystery big cats or, I don't really know what Chester. I just kind of give him free rein because
he's got the Gulf Coast gray whites thing that he's into now too.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Got, white sharks and bighorn sheep. And
he was just filming with Lyle Blackburn down in the Big Thicket.
Down in the Big Thicket. Yeah.
So
talking about the Big Thicket. Just you were talking about, Texas Parks and Wildlife wanting to get out of there. One of our investigators that was out there, on the camera project actually came down with dysentery.
Oh, wow.
Another one of our researchers actually got Lyme disease. These areas where Bigfoot inhabits, it's rough terrain, up there in Southeast Oklahoma, you got to have a four-wheel drive vehicle to get into this area. And it's it's only a several mile, but it's a several mile hour trip into these places. But, to put yourself, expose yourself to possibly getting Lyme disease or dysentery or whatever, dedicated individuals are out there conducting citizen science. And some of them are degreed and employed scientists. But we've got also Todd Neese, longtime Pacific Northwest researcher and investigator. Many, many, many expeditions up in the Pacific Northwest, going back to an encounter he had in 93 where he witnessed three different Bigfoot across a valley on the next mountainside where they were doing some demolition work. That he saw those, and he did a lot of work with Peter Byrne and Peter Byrne's research projects and has hosted for many years. Beachfoot there, as a matter of fact, the very last one is going to be this year in June up in Oregon. It's beautiful up there in the Pacific Northwest. But he has since relocated, bought a house on a mountaintop in Arkansas.
Oh, wow.
And is living there now up in northwest Arkansas and doing research and in following up on reports and doing investigations up there. And he will be speaking at the event as well. And, you know, we have guided bus tours that go around. It's about a 50-minute tour that takes people around. Yep. and shows you where some of the locations where the movie The Legend of Boggy Creek was filmed, as well as historical and some even more recent locations of sightings of the Fowlk Monster. Oh, so wow. we have that. Like I said, there'll be the catered dinner Friday night. The event, doors will open at 9 a.m. and the event is over about 6 p.m. on Saturday. You can find the event on Facebook. Yep. Chris has probably posted a link somewhere.
I have.
You can find out. I'm going to tease a little thing. There is something special that's going to be announced next week. I'm just going to let you know to watch the event page that we've got something special coming up that's going to be announced next week. Haven't announced anything yet, so your audience is getting a teaser to look for that's something right. next right. week. Nobody else even knows there's something coming up next week, but you've been a great sponsor of the event and providing AV services, so we appreciate you and appreciate you having me on to promote the event. It's always a good time. Like I said, this is the sixth annual one that I've done, starting 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. Is that 6, 7?
Wow.
19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25. The seventh annual that myself has hosted. We're going to be back at the Fowlk Community Center there. Like I said, the event is going to be really cool. We're going to have some cool vendors there. The speakers that have books and merch will be there. Unfortunately, Lyle Blackburn, who's a stalwart and a regular at the event, is not able to be there this year. It's not Ghoultown. It's his previous band, Solitude Eternus, is actually headlining
in Germany.
A metal festival in Germany the same day as the event. So Lyle will be really far away, but I think that I'm going to have some of his signed books and some of his merch there at the event for people that will be sad to miss out on Lyle that are attending. He will be, I haven't even announced that. I guess I just started to spill the beans that announcements have not been made yet for the 2025 Texas Bigfoot Conference in October 18th and 19th of this year here in Jefferson. But Lyle will be there speaking at that event. So there's another little preview and teaser for your audience that, again, speakers have not been announced.
Only right here.
We've got a headliner who has never spoken at the Texas Bigfoot Conference. So that's another teaser. A headliner who has never spoken.
Is it Bigfoot?
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Oh, that's how you know it is. that's right.
It's nobody that's ever even spoken at any event in Texas.
Wow.
So those speakers announcements will start up probably around the 1st of April, and tickets will go on sale for that event shortly thereafter. Right now we're trying to get through the Fowlk event right now. And then, you know, as you know, we've got the Texas UFO Con coming up in August. Still working on some big names for that were have got a verbal confirmation, but you know, that and 50 cents might get you a cup of coffee somewhere.
That's right.
Not at Starbucks, though. Not at Starbucks.
Never at Starbucks.
That may be $7.50. That maybe $7.50 would get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks.
It'll get you in the line for a small. That's for sure. now, in your time in the big thicket, Craig, because of course I love having Chester on and talking with him about Dark Outdoors. There are some wild things that just happen in the woods. Period.
Sure,
but especially whenever you are out in the woods for extended periods, things like that. What is for you the wildest experience that you had out in the field in that kind of way?
The wildest experience I ever had took place on Bragg Road.
Okay.
We went out there and I actually saw whatever you want to call them, the spook lights, ghost lights. Mm-hmm. I saw a very strange light in the woods. Bragg Road is an 8 mile long road that used to be a railroad track. It's straight as an arrow and, there's not much elevation change. I mean, and there is an intersection, a T intersection about halfway through. So we went down with a group of us and we weren't really doing, you know, a research organization. I mean, a research outing or anything like that. We were just going down to experience Bragg Road, the ghost lights, the yeah. ghost road. And I was riding with my good friend Gino Napoli, and we were leading the group down the road, halfway down, and then we were backing up into the T intersection. And since we were in the lead, we were the last car pulling in, backing up into the intersection. And I'm in the passenger seat and looking over to the right. And it's 10 o'clock at night, probably. I'm looking over to the right out the passenger window. And I look out and approximately, I would say, maybe 30 yards out into the woods, there was a bright light about the size of a softball that was yellowish white, that was about 3 feet off the ground, from my perspective.
Okay.
I mean, I wasn't out there measuring it.
Sure,
but
sure.
Just from gauging the distance and the size and the height off the ground. And as I watched it, it just basically started decreasing in size until it blinked out to nothing. And I found that pretty strange and unusual. Yeah. We did get out and walk around on that dirt road. Because it wasn't the main road of the main road of travel. That was the 8 mile road,
sure.
Bragg Road, where people were driving up and down. But we got out and walked around and saw another, which I never even tried to investigate. So I don't know, but it just came across to me as a weird light phenomenon. You know, the trees are out there are probably, 40, 50, 60 feet tall.
Yeah.
Out there. And we started seeing what looked like fireflies, lightning bugs.
Sure.
But they were way up in the tops of the trees.
Oh, weird.
And I don't know, like I said, I guess I could have just, Google it,
sure.
to see, but that kind of caught me off guard because I didn't really think that, lightning bugs, fireflies, flew that high.
Yeah.
I mean, when I see them, they're, certainly as a kid, catching them in a jar, yep. they're, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7, 8 feet off the ground. I've never seen them you know, up in the treetops before.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was just something else that we saw. We experienced, we had maybe, I don't know, 12 or 15 people out there in several different vehicles. And we all saw this. I think I'm the only one that saw the light that just blinked out in the woods. Mm. But all of us saw this, you know, whatever it was. You want to call it fairy lights? You want to call it whatever? I don't know what it was.
Wow.
But I definitely saw them. And like I said, they were up in the tops of the trees. And it was just a surreal experience. It was very beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, it was a dark night. And, you know, those lights flitting about in the treetops, you know, against the dark night sky was something really cool to see.
Yeah,
never seen it before or since. Of course, that's been my only trip out there. So who knows? Maybe if I go out there, we did not see the wild man of the big thicket. As Rob Riggs, my good friend who unfortunately passed away in 2015, wrote about. He spoke at my conference in the very first year in 2001, and also spoke in 2014 about his book and his experiences, you know, conducting research and investigations there.
Yeah.
In the Big Thicket and certainly there in Bragg Road area.
Well, and once you get into the Big Thicket, I don't know that even a lot of Texans have necessarily been out into the Big Thicket. You may have drove past it or through it at some point, but if you go out, there are parts of the Big Thicket specifically where you cannot see more than 15, 20 feet.
Like, sure.
It's so thick. And once you get up around that area where you're at in Saratoga, stuff like that, that is some of that area. So to look at and to be passing by and see a light, it's not like it's a flashlight in the middle of the night out in the middle of the woods. That's that thick, you know. It's not really prime camping territory.
There's not people out there walking around.
Yeah.
In those woods out there. I mean, people are driving up and down the road looking to see if they see any lights or anything. They're not getting out. Like I said, we drove in halfway and parked. So there weren't any other cars there parked in the area where we parked, which was at the T intersection of the main road, Bragg Road. So, I mean, there weren't people, you know, walking around out there in the woods. You know, there were people driving, you know, sporadically up and down the road. It was on a weekend, which, you know, you get high school kids and, you know, people that are curious and wanting to see the mystery lights, the ghost lights or whatever. But I don't think people are out there hiking around, like you said, out there in the woods.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the explanation was for this light that I saw, you know, off into the woods. I certainly didn't see anybody or any flashlights or anything other than that light, which was a ball of light that disappeared.
What an incredible experience.
It didn't move. I didn't see it, you know, moving around or floating around or anything. It appeared to be stationary and just, like I said, just decreased its size till it blinked out.
Wow. Wow. Now, with that in mind, moving back to Falk here, Falk has sightings regularly and, you know, at least a few a year.
Yeah.
On that order. And of course, Lyle Blackburn is kind of the intake point for quite a bit of that, that happens. But when people come out to the event, it's pretty frequent that I hear folks like, oh, you know, a lot of people come out and camp to come to the event. There's a campground not too far off, and quite a few of those people end up going out into the woods and going out on a hunt on their own. What advice, after your years of being out in the Big Thicket, out in those areas, Craig, what advice do you give to people, A, for a safe hunt, B, for a successful hunt?
Well, you know, first, definitely let other people know where you're at and when you're gone and when you're expected back. You know, that's the first order of business. You know, make sure you have plenty of water, plenty of provisions, that you're dressed appropriately for the weather conditions. You know, plan that you're probably going to get wet. So make sure you have dry clothes to change into, that you have a heat source, because, you know, even now when we're 80 degrees during the day at night out there, it's still down in the 40s. And it's still pretty.
Your sweat alone can cause hypothermia.
Yeah. And, you know, and like you're mentioning, you know, sightings of, you know, things out there in the Falk area, you know, just last year, the day before the event kicked off, Lyle Blackburn himself was out hiking around, following up on some information he was given about, it looked like a large pile of of bones that he was out there looking for. And he was walking ahead of his girlfriend, April, and our good friend, Glenn Haskins. They were kind of behind him a bit, and they were kind of conversing about, you know, the terrain and the good weather and, you know, how pretty it was out there. Yeah. When Lyle caught a glimpse of what he could only describe as a hair-covered bipedal animal crossing the path in front of him, not that far, I think he said maybe 20 yards in front of him.
Yeah.
It was slightly obscured by vegetation, but he definitely saw this and saw movement, saw what appeared to be dark-colored hair or fur. I believe he said that, you know, he saw legs that were moving, you know, bipedal legs.
Yeah.
And he was blown away, you know, and of course it was already had moved on by the time he got their attention, because he was trying to be fairly quiet, not to alert whatever this was that he saw. So they didn't get to see it, but they could hear it in the underbrush moving off as they got up to that area. So, you know, that's April of last year that, you know, Lyle, who has talked to many, many, many people out in that area about what they've seen out there, actually saw something himself. So, you know, there's good places to go out there. You know, there's, what's it, Alex Smith Park?
Yep.
Actually, in Doddridge, it's about 20 minutes from Falk, but there's free camping out there. A lot of the people that go to the event camp out there. There is, you know, we have a host hotel in Texarkana that has special rates for people coming in for the weekend and staying there. That you can find on the Facebook page mention of the code for the Residence Inn in Texarkana. A very nice King Suite hotel, free hot breakfast included, king bed in every room, with a folding sleeper sofa, a kitchen, a lovely hotel.
It is a great location.
And the speakers, myself, a lot of the attendees will be staying there. So, you know, we'll probably, I'm doing some hanging out, you know, in the lobby or in, you know, come down. If you stay there, come down during breakfast and you can probably have a seat with one of the speakers or myself or whatever for breakfast.
Yep.
It's just a really cool place. And it's only about 20 minutes to Falk. Like I said, Falk, I believe when I went by there, I think I saw the sign was population 845.
It's small.
When I went by the other day, back in the day, I believe with the population sign in the legend of Bayou Creek may have said population 814. I know back in the day it was 814, but I think, you know, and I just saw it as I was driving to the Monster Mart, and I had it was a quick trip because I was going to see a movie in Longview, a 4:30 film there, and we didn't get to the Monster. We didn't leave the Monster Mart till about 2:15.
Wow!
So I was in a hurry. Well, just a tip: that movie Novocaine, man, that movie is badass.
Is it?
It is. It is. And I didn't know that the star of that, who's also in the HBO series The Boys, Jack Quaid, he's actually the son of Dennis Quaid.
Yep.
And Meg Ryan. And yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah.
But that movie, I really enjoyed it. It was funny, action-packed, and I give it two non-opposable thumbs up.
Oh, wow. Scientific thumbs up at that. I will have to check that out, Craig. Well, yeah, man, thanks so much for coming on. It's always great talking with you. Always great catching up. I wish I could be at Falk this year. I'm sad I'm not at Falk. It's always a great conference. And really, more than anything for me, especially with the cryptid conferences, with Texas Bigfoot, things like that, it is a different community.
It's about the camaraderie.
It is. It really is. It's fantastic. And it's one of those that you see each other year after year. You hear each other's stories, all kinds of stuff. It's really fantastic. So thank you so much for everything that you do.
Hey, are we going to see you in Jefferson for UFO Con or
yes,
Texas Bigfoot?
Absolutely.
All right.
I'll be there. We'll talk about that.
Put that in ink on your calendar.
Absolutely. Before we let you go, let everybody know one last time where they can go to follow the Falk Monster Festival on Facebook, where they can go to get their tickets online, Craig.
There is an event page. If you look up, search the 2025 Falk Monster Festival, that will take you to the event page. You can also look up Falk Monster Festival. You can look up that on Facebook. It's cross-posted on a lot of my pages, my yep. personal profile, Texas Bigfoot Research Center page. But there is an event page with the link to the registration for the event as an event, Falk Monster Festival event. And that'll give you all the information on the speakers, the schedule of the event, all the activities involved. And that kind of stuff.
Fantastic. Man, thanks again for coming on. I appreciate it. And
let me tell you, please. Also people can find it on Lyle's website, falkmonster.net.
That's right. That's right.
There's Falk Monster, tab for the festival there.
Falkmonster.net right there. We've been popping it up here and there on screen. So make sure and visit that, folks. Make sure to stop on by the Eventbrite. Get your tickets for the Falk Monster Festival this year. Craig, once again, thank you so much for the time. We'll be in touch with links with the episode, all that kind of good stuff. Have a great festival this year.
Thank you, sir.
I hope everything goes well. We'll talk to you soon, bud.
Okay. Good night.
All right. Good night. While you are online, always great talking with Craig Woolheater. He is an amazing individual and really does put on some fantastic community events. Everything from Texas Bigfoot to Texas UFO Con to Falk Monster Fest, all kinds of things. So while you are online checking out everything from Falk Monster Festival, folks, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all of the events that we sponsor. That's where you can find all the events that are going on around the state of Texas and elsewhere. You can also find your link to Curious Research, where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log. When we come back from this quick break, we will be joined by our good friend Mike Turber from 5x5 News. We will be talking about the recently, literally within the last few hours, landed astronauts that were stranded at the International Space Station by the failed Boeing Starliner. We will be getting into that and what failures led to them being stranded and what hurdles they had to overcome to bring them home and how foolish these hurdles that they have to overcome are. And why we need standardization amongst our space programs. We will be right back after these messages, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO-UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying around. And also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like me, True Hemp Science makes some of the best products on the market. I found them a few years ago after I was prescribed CBD by my doctor for my travel anxiety. And that began my search all over the country at dispensaries as I traveled. Looking for the best products, and lo and behold, it was right here in my backyard in Austin, Texas. Christopher Lynch, the founder of True Hemp Science, makes some amazing product using a spigeric process. They use, reuse, then combust and reuse every part of the plant, from the bud to the stems to the seeds to the leaves to the shake to the roots. Everything is used, reused, combusted, and reused till nothing remains, providing an amazing full-spectrum product complete with terpene profiles. And the literally the best thing that I have found anywhere. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And get two free edibles on your way out the door as well. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Mike Turber from 5x5 News. We talked to him about so many security things, aerospace things, design things, things in the world of security. We are having him on tonight to talk about the stranded astronauts from Boeing who are now home. They have made it home. An 8-day trip turned to 9 months. You could not get more Gilligan's Island than that. And our president had something to say about that this last week. Let's hear it from Donald himself here.
In space, what is your message?
We love you and we're coming up to get you, and you shouldn't have been up there so long. The most incompetent president in our history has allowed that to happen to you, but this president won't let it happen. We're going to get them out. We're coming up to get you. I've authorized Elon. I said, can you get them out? Because, you know, they've been left up there. I hope they like each other, but they've been, maybe they'll love each other, I don't know. But they've been left up there, think of it. And I see the woman with the wild hair, good solid head of hair she's got. There's no kidding, there's no games with her hair, but...
true poetry, you know, true poetry in action. But in all sincerity, the astronauts are home now. Speaking of sincerity, hey, Mike. How you doing, buddy? Thank you so much for coming back on, as always, to talk about topics like this, because it's something that is fascinating to me. I don't know how we talked about the Boeing Starliner failures when they happened, and the fact that, like, we don't know when these astronauts are coming home. That was many, many months ago that we talked about that, Mike. So welcome back to the show.
Oh, look, bright star there. Yeah, you got me on mute.
There you go. Sorry about that. I had you muted, buddy.
Got you. Now, I said what I was saying, that the future looks bright. It just doesn't look very bright for Starliner.
That's right.
My future glasses on.
Yeah,
for
yeah.
You.
As you wear your shades at night, talking about the future looks so bright.
Exactly.
Unfortunately, the future is not that bright for Starliner. Whether or not Starliner will continue as a label within NASA, things like that, we do not know as of right now. Things are more than up in the air. It was not their first failure, though, with the Starliner. They'd had issues before. And then there were issues that delayed their launch, from communication issues, all kinds of things.
Things of that nature.
Yeah.
It's you know, one thing you have to remember, this is a CFT, it's a pre-flight test. And during these, you're going to have issues, and that's why you have, you know, these types of tests, and you have test pilots and what have you. But the issue becomes, like, in this case, they're pretty lucky that they were going to the space station. That,
yeah.
You know, not to the moon. That helps. But the other scenario that you have to look at, a lot of people wondered, you know, why that we couldn't just send up a Falcon 9 and just go grab them.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is a Falcon 9, if you get on a Dragon space capsule, you have to have their particular proprietary suit to wear. So those had to be made. Plus, they had to learn the procedures on coming home on a different spacecraft than they left, because they had never been trained on Dragon. So there's a process they had to go through anyway. And they learned all this while in space. It's the first time it's ever happened, where someone goes to space in one type of craft and they're coming home in a completely different craft. So they had to learn all that. So some of the time makes sense. But they weren't supposed to be there. This, it was June 5th, I think, was the launch. So it's been a while.
I'm
sure they have to be home.
Well, once again, 8 days, supposed to be a casual 8-day mission, go up, test systems, things like that, connect, disconnect, come home. And it was when they went to connect that they heard those horrible sounds.
And I think you and I both knew almost immediately kind of what that sound was.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually how they got, someone actually, heard that and told them that sounded like a feedback loop on an audio feed.
Yeah.
So, and they were struggling for like 24 hours trying to figure out what that was.
Yep.
Kind of an eerie sound, but, well,
you know, it's interesting, Musk was the one that went up, rescued them, all that kind of stuff. But, you'd think one of the first things that would happen with Doge would be they would go through this program, both programs, all programs that are vying for these contracts, and make sure that there is some sort of actual standard to these things, you know, things that are cross compatible. Like, as of right now, between, like you were saying, between the different brands, between Dragon capsule and the Starliner, the suits and the umbilicals and the way that they connect to life support are 180 degrees different. The only thing that is similar between them is the way that they dock to the International Space Station. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's similar between them. There's no way, once again, that a pilot from one can hop into the other and just up and go, you know.
And the idea dates all the way back to Soyuz, when it was decided that there needed to be some sort of international docking ring that be utilized in case there's some sort of, you know, tragic event or micrometeoroid or whatever.
Yeah.
And that was a good thing. That's something, you know, that you see when countries that are basically competitive with each other. And in the case of Russia, essentially enemy and becoming an enemy again, I guess. But the space programs were still operating separate. So that's so good to see to this day. I hope that continues.
Same. And granted, they haven't been doing a lot in space, things like that, because of their war with the Ukraine, all that kind of stuff. So it's not like we could have been like, hey, send a Soyuz up, you know. And yes, there have been resupply missions to the International Space Station, things like that. But most of those are automated missions, that kind of stuff. They are not return capsules to come home. Things like that.
Well, in the case of Soyuz, theirs do.
Yes.
But some of those aren't necessarily human rated. You have human rated.
Yeah. No. Exactly. They're made to get energy bars up there.
Yeah, you know? And that's why you have like Dragon crew, and then you have the Dragon resupply missions and stuff like that. It's a different set of systems, but it allows them to carry a lot more food and stuff that they need to bring up there. Which in this particular case, they brought up the extra suits that they needed to use to come home. So that was a good thing. But I think Boeing has a lot of deep insight into their own selves to figure out exactly what their future is going to be. With the budget overruns that they had, with the several test failures that they had, it's not good PR for them, especially when you go over to the civilian side, when you see the civil aviation side having a lot of issues. Boeing hopefully they'll pull through.
Well,
but
I was going to say that's something that we've spoken extensively about on the show is the failures with Boeing, not just commercially and airline wise, but with this, it's frightening when you think about that in lines with them being one of the larger defense contractors out there.
Yeah.
You know,
and one thing that I hope doesn't happen is that Doge doesn't get into a contest of going into a business like a Boeing or something like that, looking at those contracts while Musk is on board. I think that's kind of a conflict, and I think it would probably create more issues. We've already seen it a little bit where ideally that situation gets resolved because, I think that Department of Government Efficiency is aptly named.
Yes.
As you think about where'd they get that series of letters from? Quite obvious there.
But in all sincerity, you know, I'll flash it up on screen again. The rift, and this is something that really needs to be addressed along with the standardization of things, you know, because without the standards, how do we cross-compat stuff? How do we make sure that something like this doesn't happen again? You know, and when you look at the budgetary difference,
right,
between the Dragon capsule and the Starliner was $4.2 billion compared to $2.6 billion for Dragon. You know, right. That's crazy. That's crazy. That is a large chasm of a difference in funding, like to 1.5 times.
And the cost per seat difference between the 90 million versus what the other one was 50 or 55 or something like that. I think that number is probably way off base.
Well, 90 million to 55 million, you know?
Yeah.
And that's that, just so you know, folks, that is per seat, per number of people that can fit in the cabin. So, you know, and that means life support systems for each, you know, all that kind of stuff. But even that is a massive gap of a difference, almost double.
And if you're looking at it and if you looked at both capsules side by side and didn't know anything about them, who made them, nothing, there's no identifying marks on them. And you looked inside and you would ask yourself, gee, I wonder which one costs 90 million and which one costs less. You would probably choose Dragon every time. It's just, it looks so futuristic. I remember the first time seeing the inside of that. And I was actually parked in the Dragon parking lot in Hawthorne. And when I got to see the mock-up that they had, I was floored. I was like, wow, this is truly Star Trek kind of level here. It's just so the lines were clean. Everything is just so nice. There's no switches and buttons and all these different things. But then you know, that fear factor part comes in your mind. It's like, well, that could also be a catastrophic thing if something happens without a series of redundancies and stuff like this, because I can repair a switch. What am I going to do with software, right?
Well, and that is something that I have openly said on this show, that I don't know if I would step into a Dragon capsule because there is no hard bypass. There's no hard mm-hmm. bypass option. And when you look at the Dragon or the Starliner, like there's granted, these are all soft buttons. They're yeah. all encoders. It's not like an actual potentiometer, you know, mm-hmm. that you're turning or something like that. They're all encoders right. that are leading to software. However, there's still something that you can bypass that's right. there. You know, it's
something funny about the mechanical nature of something as opposed to yes. something being so offhand. So I'm comfortable in both worlds, but when it comes down to something where I'm flying an aircraft or something yeah. like that, yeah, I kind of have that feeling of, you know, safety
yeah.
and security when I can see familiar instruments that have been around yeah. for a long time.
And familiar ways to work. There's a reason why, and it doesn't matter what position you are in an STS mission, in a shuttle mission for NASA, everybody right. going up has to have some kind of engineering background. Everybody. Mm-hmm. Even Christy McCullough had yeah. some engineering background in her, you know,
yeah.
and that's why she was allowed to go up. Aside from that, you learn everything as far as being an astronaut. But the whole reason behind that engineering background is so that, A, you can somewhat at least hack your way through a schematic.
Right. And problem solving.
And pull an Apollo 11 where, like, we're going to have to walk you through this. You ready to yeah. go? So you have some duct tape and Velcro, right? Cool. And we're going to walk you through saving your life in outer space with your engineering skills.
Yeah, you know? I think Apollo 13, that was one hell of a,
yeah, 13, of a wake-up sorry. Problem
for yeah. yeah, no problem. I forget to put that dig in. No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, that was an incredible
yeah.
thing to watch unfold, especially the way the movie portrayed it and everything like that. It was just really neat to see the ability to problem solve on the fly.
Yeah.
And you can't do that in a craft that doesn't really have all these extra wires hanging in. Let's take yeah. the vent from up here. And let's yeah. take this from
well,
here.
We don't need that switch. Let's cut the wires and permanently put them together.
Exactly.
You know, so it's system connected. You know,
but I think overall, in the short term, I think Boeing is going to essentially continue to try to keep Starliner a viable thing. And NASA does like having some sort of redundant program between two competing companies or whatever. It doesn't matter as long as they have some sense of redundancy. But the way I see it long term, I just don't really see it happening unless some major changes at Boeing itself are handled, because they have a lot of internal issues, as evidenced by, you know, they remember the guy that was going to go do the testifying whistleblower
yep.
out of there, and then, you know, a bunch of other whistleblowers popped up until, you know, he was found not alive.
Yeah.
And you know, those issues make people question a lot of other things. I mean, if they're having these issues on this side, they're having issues with the aviation side, and they're having issues with internal whistleblowers talking about them cutting corners on,
yeah.
on putting switches out and things of that nature. There needs to be a government oversight in that, and it can't just be the FAA. It can't just be NASA sending some guy there
yeah.
checking off lists periodically. It really needs to be someone watching that entire process as it goes through. And part of the reason for that is not necessarily that accidents do happen. We realize that. But also on a bigger scale, when an accident happens, it basically hurts our country. It hurts our standing and things of that nature. So having some sort of ongoing program to oversee that is something important. Now, supposedly they obviously would have that, but it's not the way people think. It's not someone that's there working inside their facility day to day, watching operation yeah. and helping check off those lists. It's not to that level, but you know, we'll see. We'll see how this pans out. And, hopefully, they can turn it around and make something good out of it.
Well, hopefully. And once again, it's a strange thing. And granted, you know, once again, failures happen. I mean, hey, Musk has lost no less than 2 rockets in the last 3 months, you know. And when you play with rockets, you're literally just playing with explosives in a big container with right. with a very controlled outlet, you know. Even my son with his first rocket, you know, I was very excited. He got it at Christmas. It was a little electronic one, and I had to warn him. You may not get this back one day. You're going to launch it, and the wind's going to catch it. It's going to go.
Yeah. I lost a $2,000 drone.
Sure enough, that first day, he lost his rocket on top of the school, you know, because the wind caught it, took it, and, you know, that's rocketry. That's how that works. You know, you're not going to bang 100%. It just doesn't work that way. So at what point do you halt funding to a program, Michael? At what point does that stop, you know? At what point does something become the little Chevy Nova of the skies?
It needs to be part of the program. I mean, that needs to be part of an issue. If they exceed costs by X percent, then this cancels the program automatically. It's an automatic thing.
Yeah.
If they have a safety issue that prolongs, keep in mind that Starliner was going to had several missions already planned to, you know, to go to the space station, what have you. And when those didn't go, SpaceX picked up on those. So you have these provisions should be built into the program that, look, if you can't get it together within X amount of time or X amount of cost, then your program will be automatically shut down. And that's it. You know, and that's effectively, you know, how it should be done. But as always happens, is the companies petition to the government and say, hey, we're doing this and we had this cost overrun due to unforeseen circumstances, which obviously all circumstances are unforeseen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I love it when they say unforeseen circumstances have caused this. Well, if you would have seen them, then they wouldn't be unseen circumstances causing the issue. Some of the terms that people use are just hilarious. But the in the long run, you know, Boeing needs to be a viable part of that space community and produce products that will push our, you know, frontier forward. This is our final frontier.
Here's the thing, though. They are a vital part of the aviation community, and they have been a vital part of many space projects before.
Right.
You know, how is it that Firefly Aerospace, literally right here in my backyard, with a facility no larger than a friggin' super Walmart, can land on the moon and wreck it? And just like, hey, here's the lunar eclipse from the moon, like first time out, you know. But yet again, here's Boeing, contractor since the beginning of contractors, just about, you know, one of the literal competitors for people like Howard Hughes.
Yeah,
you know, like Boeing's been around longer than Lockheed.
Well, back in the day, a lot of this stuff was done by a type of acquisition where companies would acquire other companies. You got, you know, Lockheed Martin, you got McDonnell Douglas, and you have these different companies that grew and acquired technology through acquisition. Then you have a company come along that's a true game changer like SpaceX, who basically went to, you know, remember Elon went to Russia to look at buying some of the rocket motors and what have you. And that became a joke, a running joke in the industry. But he basically came back and said, I'm going to build it. And the transition of the, like the Raptor engine, for example, what that engine has gone through is so clean now to see that engine and compared it to the Raptor 1 and the Raptor 3 is coming out. It's an amazing thing. And the efficiency of the motors has exceeded anything that he could have got essentially from Russia, including the RS-25. So as you look forward and you try to determine, okay, who's, you know, there's good and bad on each one. But when you advance through acquisition, are you truly advancing? If you acquire someone else's technology and you pull it in your fold, I get it. That makes sense. It's a quick way to do things. But if you develop the technology and do it in many ways the way Elon's in, because a lot of people have questioned, you know, you launch a rocket to test it, see if it works, and then you learn from that and you keep doing it, which is what's happening with the Starship.
Yeah.
And when you look at how expensive that would normally be, could you imagine the government saying, okay, we're going to launch 8 Starships, and of that, we expect maybe only 2 will probably, you know, make it through. People would have a hard time with it, especially with the amount of money that they put into it. But the way Musk is doing it and the way they're planning on mass producing those things, that's done from the beginning. It's done from the beginning to mass produce that rocket and try to make as much of it reusable as possible. Yeah. And that factors into the cost factor that that Boeing, you know, for years and years and years, they've made X amount of dollars with the cost overrun. So it's kind of programmed into their system, I guess. I don't want to speak for them.
But yeah. Yeah.
That's not the right way to run a business is knowing you're going to expect some overruns and delays, and that'll keep that part of the business going. And I don't think they necessarily went into it with that mindset, but it just seems to where it happens so often, we expect it now.
Well, what it does, Mike, it's not necessarily that they built it in or anything like that, but what it does is speak to a corporate mentality.
It does.
It really speaks to a corporate mentality whenever, and believe me, there's a lot of things, folks, that I am not a fan of Elon for, you know, like speaking of Ford Novas, like the Tesla now has a worse road record than the Nova. As far as fire deaths, like more people have died in fires in their own Tesla than died in the Chevy Nova. And that was one of the first cars ever pulled for safety concerns. He just had to pull a full recall on a whole series of them because the panels are falling off the side, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a prime example, like you were saying, of what happens through acquisition instead of creation. Mm-hmm. Many people forget the fact that Elon purchased Tesla. They were a company that had tons of pre-orders for the first models and stuff like that before he purchased them, you know? And it's interesting to see that evolve into what is now the Tesla, when once again, the Falcon 9 and the Dragon capsule and everything else are raving success. Because it was scratch ground up, you know, and mm-hmm. when it's scratch ground up, you are literally, you're cooking things in a different way. You're thinking about things in a different way. It's no longer, how do we take what we have and move forward? It's how do we create what we need at the end with the fewest steps possible here?
Yeah.
You know,
and here's a quick case in point. Tim Dodd, Everyday Astronaut. He was visiting with Musk at their facility, the Boca Chica facility, and they were going over some different things about the rockets. And he mentions to Musk, he's like, well, they were talking about the thrusters, but using a hot gas thruster. And when Tim said something to Musk about, well, maybe you could do this. And Musk literally stopped dead in his tracks right there and shook his head like this. He says, you know what? That's right. We're good. That's what we should do.
Yeah.
I mean, when someone can take an idea from a space enthusiast, which is what Tim Dodd pretty much is, and make a change that fast and accept the fact that you don't have to have a whole team of people try to research and figure this out, blah, 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 and just do it. It makes more sense. And that's kind of what makes some of these companies operate a little better when you have someone at the helm like Elon Musk, who has it, and not necessarily, he's not like, you know, an engineer to an extent that we would call him an engineer, but he's done things and he has to learn enough about it to know how that operates, to the point where he probably knows a lot more about engineering than a lot of engineers do. But the end result is that you get a company that can streamline, learn from their mistakes quickly and adapt. That's something you're not going to see at the old school large companies like the Boeings and some of the other ones. The only other company I've seen that has anything like what Musk has, I'd have to look at Skunk Works and look at Lockheed Martin, where they did do a lot of things on the fly, and they got a lot accomplished. And most of the records in the world that are held by any aircraft, that they make an aircraft that fits into that category, they own the records. So. Yeah.
Well, and I think that comes from a truly collaborative team spirit of quite literally how do we accomplish the impossible?
Yeah.
You know, not how do we take a task to the next level but how do we do something that's literally never been done?
The way they used to do it was throw money at it. You throw money at problems, and that makes the problem go away. And sometimes it really didn't. People can say what they want about Musk or Trump or anything, but when it comes down to trying to drive the point home that something needs to be more efficient, I think I could see that, especially in Musk and his ability to streamline the process of getting something done. And if something doesn't need to be there, it needs to go. I mean, that's how they got rid of so many parts on some of the cars. But going forward, does Boeing have a viable product that I think will be here 5 to 10 years from now, or 15 years from now? Honestly, I don't really see it. I hope they can, but
I'm at a non-confidence in it. Especially at this point, they already had raging failures with the Starliner program to begin with, and to see this failure,
And even though the Starliner capsule did come back and it was okay, made its landing in New Mexico, that's where it landed. All of these precautions that they put into place, it's quite a bit different on a crewed mission. As opposed to, non-crew mission, there are some different flight parameters and stuff that they have to take into account. But overall, I just see the old way of doing business in this industry is much like what I've seen in several other industries, that the old style thinking is not working anymore. Look at the retail industry. I mean, look at retail superstores and stuff like that. All the stores that you and I grew up with, that are not here anymore because they stuck to the old business model.
Yeah.
Blockbuster being probably one of the funnier ones. But in the end, Boeing has a lot to do. Their CEO took a huge bonus in light of letting a lot of people go. They have to streamline somewhere. And I do believe in paying CEOs quite well. But I couldn't be a CEO and be paid that much money only to see a whole bunch of people that grew up with the company, whatever, have to leave. And then to be facing the problems that you're facing. Why would you pay anyone a bonus if their company is facing this many problems with their aircraft, with their spacecraft, and various other things that they produce? It's a huge company. But they need to get back together.
Well, and once again, that budget chasm, where quite literally, and I'll flash it up on screen again, $4.2 billion for Starliner, $2.6 billion for Crew Dragon. And it's staggering. It's literally enough for another program.
You know,
like we could have another James Webb telescope for that much money and be discovering more about interstellar science. It's staggering to think about that. When you look at, once again, a company that has been entrenched in government contract for not since World War II, producing aircraft for the government, things like that, it does bear to witness, like, what is the next step? Because obviously it's not working anymore. When you're talking about private industry being able to hoop it through the net first time, and government contractors not being able to make their stuff orbit properly, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. We have a distinct problem there.
We do. And the way the political process works and the way they politicize how these contracts are managed, given out. If you don't know somebody in there, it's going to be hard to do. But, you know, along comes a company like SpaceX, that does some amazing things that people told them were impossible. You know, you're not going to create a reusable spacecraft like you're saying, and, you know, just not going to happen. And then, you know, Elon does not know those words of failure, those words of give up. It's just not part of his vocabulary. I wish I was as strong-minded as that in some degree, but, you know, you watch someone go through what he's gone through to get this program to where it's at. It's amazing. And I think that's what's going to have to happen with companies like Boeing. They have to see the shakeup and go, okay, well, you know, we need to shift gears. And if we're going to remain a viable company and for over the next 5 to 10 years, which they'll be around, obviously.
Oh, sure.
But in space industry, it's going to be iffy at best.
They have deliveries extending out through the next 7 years. Yep. You know, so it's like they whether or not they take any new orders, they will be around for the next decade. Absolutely. You know, like you could stop giving them government contracts right now. It doesn't mean that they don't still have to fulfill the ones that they have.
Right.
And that they don't still have to keep producing for Airbus and, you know, things like that and smaller airlines and everything else. But once again, one of my favorite movies, it's become one of my favorite movies in the last couple of years, is The Aviator. With Leonardo DiCaprio. He depicts one of my heroes growing up in Houston, Howard Hughes. An amazing aviator, an amazing air designer, and one of the main competitors for Boeing, when that world really first started. You know, that was the time before government contract for private industry in such a way. It's literally what Ike warned us about on his way out, was these contractors have come in. Like, we had to give them access to a lot of things that they ain't supposed to have access to, and you need to kick them out, or else you're going to have problems later. And now we're up against the problems. We're straight up against those problems. Where's the accountability? You're talking billions of dollars for programs, not just billions a year, billions of dollars per program going to things. The results aren't there. And they're now so entrenched in the system that how do you and that's part of the movie, is they try trying Howard Hughes for bribery, for taking all these generals and things like that out to dinner and dancing and things like that. And he's like, I don't think you understand how this industry works, Senator. Exactly. That's exactly how this industry works. Like, we do. We take them out to steak dinners. We take them out to the strip club. Like, that's I don't know how you think we get these contracts.
Well, the other thing is that over half of the contractual work that's done with the government, or just if you think of it this way, over half of the government employees, if you want to think of it as a contractor being an employee, are done by not NGOs. I mean, it's over 50% now, whereas before you may have 20% of your government workforce was actually employed by the government. But you have a lot you can do with when you deal with contractors, and that one, they don't have to worry about the FOIA requests and having to, you know, give up proprietary information. Yeah. So they have that as a guild. And various other things, the competition factor, there is some competition when you're looking at government, because it's in competition with itself. You could argue some of the, like the U.S. Postal Service versus UPS. I mean, a lot of people argued that, hey, that's a government entity, basically competing with a non-government entity, and that's not supposed to happen. But in the long run, I think what we'll see is that these companies that, are here and for the here and now, may not be here and now in a few years. I don't want to make any predictions or anything like that, but when you walk into a facility and then you walk into that same facility years later and you see the differences and then the things that aren't different.
Yeah.
You know, that makes you wonder. I mean, I go to Plant 42 periodically, and when I visit there, you see how one company, and literally across the tarmac to the other side, you see the competing company and you see how both operate with inside the same facility. And then you go, okay, well, one's more government oriented and the other is more private kind of oriented and can move a little quicker. They're not tied up with red tape and stuff like this. But when you see it firsthand, then you start thinking, man, is the writing on the wall for this other company? I'm not going to mention names, but
sure.
It's important that as we move forward, especially in this industry, in the space industry, it's not a highly competitive industry. There's not a whole lot of people doing it, even though sometimes you would think that. But at the same time, you have to get this stuff right the first time, you know, as best you can. There's not a lot of leeway for failure. Most companies can't, you know, fail one launch and survive, you know. So there's a lot of these startup companies that had, you know, their first and second rocket didn't work and they were gone. And keep in mind, SpaceX was almost in that same category where if they didn't make that first launch of the Falcon, if it would not have gone off on the fourth launch or the fourth try, the third time's a charm, depending on how you measure the launches, you know, they would possibly not be here. And that was a hard question for Elon to answer during an interview. I saw that one time where he was asked that question. And it's tough. But he put his own money into it, and he spent many nights on the factory floor and what have you as they tried to build various companies. And he's done that with each company that he's built. He puts his heart and soul into it. And that's you got to admire that, regardless of what you think of Musk or Trump or whoever. You got to admire it, at least that work.
Well, and I've said, you know, you can personally think whatever you like of Musk. I would like you to find me another industrialist that leaves his patents open source,
right,
for people to build on top of. And you know, speaking of other industrialists in space and things like that, like there's Blue Origins out there, you know, who just completed their flight with the new Glenn booster and Glenn rocket. So they may be in the race for things fairly soon. And then, of course, there's Virgin Space, you know, from Richard Branson, who's much more about, I think, trying to market the world of low Earth orbit flights. I think that's much more his market is looking at things from a consumer side. How do we consumerize space? You know,
and they're kind of out of that a little bit right now. But as far as you know, when you look at Bezos, is you know they're taking up it's $250,000 a seat for you know to put someone at 300,000 feet or hit the Kármán line and just a little bit beyond it. Those kind of things are kind of neat. But when you see that a balloon, you know, can offers a similar view. It's not going to make you weightless, but the view that they can do for far less. You see that competition in that low Earth orbit to people just wanting to do space tourism. When you see the first space hotel go up, that is going to be, I think, the game changer. When your average everyday person, you know, who has some money, obviously, does that, and then you have it right on screen.
Yeah. And I mean, hey, like I'm all about flying, man. I love flying. Don't get me wrong. Bernoulli's principle. It's great. Physics is awesome. I don't know if I could be suspended from a freaking balloon like that.
Yeah.
The plus side is that there's a parachute. There's all kinds of recovery systems. But my God, that just looks epically frightening. Like I'd much rather be strapped to explosives than to have the slow ascent of a balloon to get me to space.
I think exactly it would be cool, but at the same time, I don't want to be almost in space.
Like, just get me there. Just get me there. I can deal with a minute and a half long ride.
I want that free fall. Sure.
That to me is an acrophobe, as somebody who's afraid of heights. Like, that's like the suspense of taking me onto a 15-story drop ride, where it's like you just go up there and you're just hanging out with your feet suspended. Like, I have no interest. I have no need to see my house, but I'll ride a roller coaster all day and do triple corkscrews and all kinds of stuff. Love it.
all day long, but I will not just sit up there staring into oblivion waiting to drop.
This comes from the guy that I watched lit on fire.
Yeah,
and
no, I'm telling you, man, there is an acrophobic part of me. Even think about it right now. My palms are sweaty. My palms are sweaty just thinking about hopping in this balloon and just slowly ascending to space. And don't get me wrong. I've considered going on a hot air balloon ride to maybe get over some of my fear of such things.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about it. I think that would be a nice, safe way to do it. I would definitely, oddly, probably have a harness on with a fall arrest just to be like, hey, buddy, it's not that I don't trust you. I just don't trust my own self. And I'd probably be sitting in the bottom of the basket for about half the ride. Just like, is it over? Are we done yet?
I've seen people overcome that that fear of heights through virtual reality.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
It gives you everything. I mean, you know you're safe, so you experience it. But the visuals that tell your mind what's going on are the same.
Yeah.
And so some people, when they get in, they have bad experience with it, but then you can keep doing it until you actually lose that fear.
Funny because I can rock climb in a gym. I can climb up 40 feet, all kinds of things. I can climb a 30-foot ladder with a projector. You know, once again, my palms may sweat on the way up, but I'm in my zone and I'm doing my work. But to just float up to the point of oblivion and seeing the curvature of the earth, I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of like being a spacewalker and knowing that, like, sure, you're safe, you have numerous safety systems, but you were wrecking shop at about 10,000-15,000 miles an hour.
They were thinking of having like cruise ships, but it would be a cruise dirigible. Basically a blimp that's imagine having a cruise ship on the water. You have a cruise ship in the sky, it would be some blimp type thing. And I could see where that would be a pretty cool thing to have. And it looks like that's probably going to happen as well.
And it seems like the space elevator is definitely a go.
Yeah.
You know,
Japan's pushing forward for it. So they just need the materials to do that with. And they, with graphene and these other materials that are the metamaterials and stuff like that, that are being worked on, we may see that in our lifetime. I mean, the space elevator is just an amazing feat of engineering.
Yeah.
And if people don't know what that is, basically you take an object, you place it in space, and you have it match the orbital velocity of what's on the ground, so to speak, on Earth, so that you could suspend a wire from that object to the ground and attach an elevator to it and ride an elevator up into space.
Yeah.
So that would be probably the least expensive way you can get something to space. It'd also be extremely terrifying for you to take the elevator ride up. That would be pretty scary.
Yeah.
But it would be fun.
Well, and once again, things like this, not necessarily for human transport, but more for refuel, things like that.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating. And to see Musk now having the plan, a real plan of going to Mars and returning from Mars with methane from Mars, pretty fascinating stuff. Really exciting stuff in that world. I'm happy we were able to go and get these people back. I mean, guaranteed, like I've told my wife the whole time, like they will come home. It will happen. All it took was enough time to produce the suits for them without them actively being there for fittings, stuff like that. But
learning the Dragon capsule stuff and, the way Musk has pushed the multiplanetary thought is good. But from a scientific standpoint, it's not really that necessary the way people think. Is that, like, if an asteroid's heading to Earth, which is going to be the most cost effective thing to do, is to move people to Mars or to just put the money into a program that would destroy that asteroid? or slightly nudge it away and what have you.
Bunkers are a whole lot easier. We can make that happen pretty quickly, you know.
Yeah.
Especially with the Boring Company.
What a great name.
He's covered all bases. But quite literally, I think that's what a lot of people don't realize. Even the electric vehicles and purchasing the electric vehicle companies, things like that, every bit of that was for his plan to go to Mars and to take humanity to Mars. The only reason he's researching it is so that we can build Mars buggies and transportation on Mars, things like that. The only reason he has the Boring Company is so that we can learn to use something the size of an 18-wheeler to help build bases on Mars, to help protect us from radiation and the thin atmosphere, things like that. You know, because, there's no way without very specific housing, things like that, that a human is going to be able to survive the radiation of Mars with the atmosphere that it has. You know, you would have to have very specific suits to make that happen, very specific housing. But if you're underground, that's a different story.
Living on Mars is going to have quite a few issues. Remember that a while back when they were talking about terraforming Mars, one of the options was to nuke the ice caps to get them to melt.
Yep.
And people, you know, when they hear that, you start questioning things like, wait, you're going to fly to Mars, take nuclear weapons, which is not legal right now anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe you get a pass and nuke the polar ice caps to get them to create more of an atmosphere and also to get water. A lot of people have a problem with that. We go to another planet and we start blowing up parts of it. And we had the same issue when we were thinking about going to the moon. If we signed that treaty about going to the moon, that the moon is for all humanity, similar to how we did Antarctica. We realized that. But being a multiplanetary society, that sounds funny, is an important aspect of our future growth. It's a natural progression for mankind to make.
Absolutely.
But you just can't do it on the premise that the Earth, you can't sell the smarter people on the, we're going to do this because, you know, an asteroid may hit the Earth. Well, wouldn't it be cheaper just to move the asteroid or take it out?
Yeah.
And that's another issue with the asteroids is that they're going to be mining them for what they have. And, you know, you don't have mineral rights like you have here on Earth. Just go get it.
The whole concept of space mining and things like that is very fascinating. And yes, there are numerous companies, one right out of Texas here, that is actively using remote viewers to find asteroids to target for rare earth minerals and gold, things like that. So the possibilities are vast when it comes to the opportunities there. And yes, we did have the DART mission recently, which was fairly successful. As far as hitting an asteroid, impacting an asteroid, but you know, what would it take, to possibly redirect one, you know?
And the funny thing about the DART, a lot of people don't understand is we didn't hit the asteroid that was in question. We hit the little satellite that was going around the asteroid. So we had an asteroid with its own moon.
Yep.
And instead of hitting that huge asteroid, we just hit the small moon with the impactor, and then that caused enough difference that we can measure and tell that it was successful. It's something that could work. You don't want to blow up an asteroid and have 1,000 problems as opposed to one.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So I think that was explored in Armageddon. There are reasons to do this, and it's inevitable that we should do it, become interplanetary or what have you. But in the long run, more in the short term, I guess, you know, how much money would you think to put into that? If someone like Musk is doing it, then it's a company. It's not a country. And people, you don't have, but some of that will be subsidized by government funding because you kind of have to, because some of the technology that's being explored is technology that NASA will need to acquire anyway.
Yeah.
So it would justify them putting that money into some programs or some grants or whatever to get that done. But the moon is first. The moon is where we're going next.
Yep.
And we're going to put a permanent base there on the moon. And that will be our stepping stone to get to Mars.
Well, so, and we basically have to have that. That's because at some point, you've got to refuel to get there, at least as far as carrying anything of any capacity goes. And of course, I mean, we only have 6 minutes left to go into the rocket equation is an episode in and of itself. And the idea, the metric idea of the rocket equation, where every pound of payload added adds 2 pounds of fuel.
Right.
Which is then 2 pounds of payload. Right. Which, so like to get a 2,000 pound object on the moon ends up requiring 20,000 pounds of fuel to get it into orbit, you know? Yeah. So the question is, how do we push that through space without running out of fuel just to get it into orbit? The answer is refueling stations in orbit, you know, or you launch a rocket that then has enough fuel. And that's kind of their plan with the Dragon capsules and the heavy boosters is to launch two, one with fuel, one with payload, one behind the other. As it gets up and this releases, this one with whose payload is only fuel, then meets up, reverses, docks with the other rocket, refuels it, and then that one comes back down with its remaining fuel to land, and the other continues to Mars, that then comes back with methane made on Mars.
Right.
So fascinating concept, really interesting concept. But once again, you have to refuel in space to get there with that kind of payload. We've never had to do that before because the plan was never to come back. We just sent robots. Right. We sent rovers, things like that. So we don't necessarily need them. Like once they're in orbit, it can take the 6 months to get there. Doesn't matter if the retrieval vehicle comes back or not.
And new concepts and propulsion and stuff like that is what's key. The next generation of rockets would be plasma rockets. It won't be the traditional hyperbolics that we use now.
Yeah.
And the things of that nature that could, in some ways are bad for the atmosphere, but except when you mix hydrogen and oxygen together, you just get water vapor. So that's cool.
Sure.
And that's something that we can make on the moon. There seems to be there to do that.
And something that you can absolutely use, like once you're in orbit, once again, if it isn't coming back, you can use all kinds of systems to help boost it to get there. Everything else, ion engines, ion thrust engines, things like that, that will move things in a zero gravity environment with great efficiency, actually, trying to break the bonds of Earth and gravitational pull. You need real raw. It's kind of like the hoverboard in Back to the Future too. You need power. You Bojo. It can't run on water. You need power. It's a wild equation. Look it up, folks. It's something that'll groundhog your mind for a day, quite literally. The rabbit holes that go along with it are really, really interesting when it comes to physics and how we get into orbit and how you get payloads into orbit and what it costs. It's fascinating stuff. I remember the day I found out about it. It led to weeks worth of research.
If you develop a propulsion system that doesn't stop, basically, like right now we have to launch a booster, then whatever we're launching goes on top of that in the second stage. The booster, 80% of the fuel that's used on a launch is used by the booster just to get the object close to space.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the rest goes on. But if you're already in space, then you don't have that. And so if we could build things in space, give them 1G acceleration, which is nothing. Like 1G, you can't really even feel it. But 1G acceleration, if you were traveling at 1G for 1 year, you would be at or near the speed of light at that point.
Yeah.
Which is kind of amazing.
Well, and especially whenever you're talking solar powered things like that, You can do some really interesting things at that point, because once again, it doesn't require a whole lot of energy to create an ion engine.
Right.
You know,
or fire a laser at your solar sail.
Yeah.
To keep going. So then that's another thing where they want to put the laser on the moon.
Yep.
So you don't have to fire it through the atmosphere. There's all kinds of neat things that are on the horizon. Sometimes I wonder, was I born at the right time? I definitely want to say yes, because we get to see a lot of cool things and remember the old school ways. But people that are being born right now, they're going to be in for some really trippy times, because there's all kinds of interesting things. They may see someone go to Alpha Centauri and back, you know, in their lifetime. I don't think we'll see it in ours, obviously. But that for me would be truly becoming an interstellar.
And with discovering things like the connective tunnels in space-time, things like that, I think we will be able to come very, very close to what we consider to be, quote, warp speed. You know, if we can figure out how to tie into those and use those energies, and it's going to be a phenomenal world. And we really, really do have some amazing opportunities for space flight and manned space travel in front of us. It's going to be great.
I think so as well. And, I believe so.
You know, just to kind of wrap this, it's one of those, we have to have accountability, Mike. And when it comes to these programs, when it comes to these things, I am all about, I'm all about industrialization. I got no problem with that. I got no problem with private groups doing things. That is how science excels. That's how you move science along. However, when it comes to these endeavors, like putting man in space, putting man on Mars, putting man back on the moon, things like that, we've got to have universal systems. We cannot any longer have three, four different space outfits out there using three, four different life support systems to connect people, you know. That's what's created this problem and what's left these people in space for now 9 months. And yes, people have spent way longer in space. The Kelly twin spent over a year in space, you know. But suffered some damage because of it, suffered some mitochondrial damage from radiation, now wears glasses, whereas he didn't before, things like that. So there are definite issues, bone density loss, all kinds of things. It's why they have them on the exercise regimens they have, things like that, is to because the body isn't made to be in zero gravity. It's really not a single part of your body is made to do that. The only time that you are like that is literally when you are in the womb. Your first fight is with gravity because you're trying to float in there, you know. But quite literally, since the time you come out of the womb, you are gravitationally bound, you know, and tied to that force. And it controls a lot of your biology. So once you get up there for an extended period, things start happening. And yeah, they may suffer some ill health effects. But it's something that every astronaut is aware of whenever they go up. You know, it's not like they sent them up there without telling them what the long-term exposure effects may be of being up there. If something happens and you're up there for a while, these things may happen to you, you know.
Right.
But we've got to have a universal way for these programs to talk and work and cooperate with each other for this reason exactly.
Amongst companies and amongst countries. I mean, it needs to be a universal type system where we all agree on some standards and we run with it. And it's not for standards to make one particular country or company, you know, make more money or be, you know, more profitable or whatever. It literally needs to be all the spacefaring nations get together and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. And that way you have that. It drives the cost down.
Yeah.
If everyone's on the same program.
Yeah.
You know, you're not trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel, so to speak.
Well,
but yeah,
precisely. I mean, at that point you can quite literally, create things so much faster because you've got an international consortium working on it. When you're talking about the Indian space program, the Japanese space program, the Chinese space program, the Russian space program, the Korean space program. There's numerous space programs out there that all go to the International Space Station and do work. So they all know what it is to have that universal docking mechanism that you have to have, know? So it's not like it's a protocol that's out of bounds to ask for or to look for whatsoever. It's just funny to me that it doesn't apply to, like, hey, here's how the emergency rescue system works. And it works that way on all of them. Here's how you connect your oxygen and your heart monitor. And it works that way on all of them.
Yeah.
You know?
And the FAA is, we basically invented flight, so to speak, kitty hop.
Sure.
And the world kind of looked towards the United States to take the lead as far as aviation is concerned. It's kind of done that. And so when you look around the world, you see how that agenda, if you want to call it that, of pushing our technology to the other countries was not exactly how it happened. But it's interesting, if you go through aviation history, it's going to be similar to what's kind of is going to happen here. Multiple countries and companies and competing technologies and what have you, one saying they're better than the other. But at some point in time, they have to adopt a standard that they run with it. I think you're right.
That's just it. I mean, that's really all it comes down to, is an international standard. Hey, you know, maybe someday we'll lose standard and join the international standard of metric, and that'll be the step forward. Who knows? but quite literally, like, that in and of itself speaks to the problem. The fact we are still the only holdout that's not metric, you know, like that speaks to the problem of how we allow four different companies to develop a product literally for the same people, NASA, and not a single one of them has the same unified system among them for these kinds of things.
And that's also a mission to Mars, because the person that did the calculation for sending a particular probe to Mars did it improperly, because they were taking into account metric versus the imperial system. And screwed up. And just because of that, that whole $150-200 million probe missed Mars. The calculation error based on that exact premise. So I could see the benefits there. And hopefully we'll all come around to that, and we'll enjoy the benefits of the fruits of that. I hope so
as well, Mike. So thank you as always for coming on, breaking these things down, because it's a nebulous topic for a lot of people. Most people do not follow the world of space news. They see the news, they see space mentioned in it, but they don't follow developments of technology. They don't follow things in the world of government contractors the way you do, even the way I do. You know, like most of these government contractors and stuff, like, I have their RSS feeds on my RSS reader. So whenever they post things about, like, this new thing made, like, I'm in the know, I check it out. But you are on a different level with it. And it's great to see your realm of knowledge. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing that with us, man.
Oh, thank you for being there. I always love being on your show, and you've become a very valued friend.
Same.
So happy to have met you, and thank you, Shannon, out there, if you watched this episode, for hooking us up.
That's right, buddy. That's right. Before we let you go, man, where can everybody go to follow the work of 5x5 News? Where can they go to keep up with you, to like, follow, subscribe, all that good stuff, Mike?
Well, the good news is we're developing a website that will kind of steer things around. So you can just go to 5x5news.com at that point. But for right now, YouTube, TikTok, and on X, any of those three platforms, you'll be able to see what we're doing. Some are updated more so than others. I'm thinking the next couple of months, we'll probably be on TikTok more than anything. And we'll move forward from that. Always looking towards the future.
Same here, bud. You're more of a fool than I am. That's why I love you, buddy. Oh, thanks so much for coming on, as always, man. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you are online checking out everything from Mike Turber and 5x5 News, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, and subscribe. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That is where you can comment on things. That's also where you can find our videos page, curiousrealm.com/videos. That's where you can find all of our video episodes, as well as the video channels from YouTube of all of our guests, including Mike Turber and 5x5 News. Make sure also to stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store, and you can buy your copy of The Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFOs, UAPs, The Experiencer and Encounter Log is your back pocket field data log to write down all of your experience data as it happens in the field, so that your data is ready to shake hands with science come the day it needs to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what it takes to make the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.